This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by the Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. Did you know that olive oil is at its peak of flavor and nutrition right after it's fresh pressed at harvest time? That's why my favorite olive oil is delivered to me direct from the latest harvest, thanks to the Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. And now you can try a bottle yourself, normally $39, for just $1, with no obligation to buy anything else. Visit myfavoriteoliveoil.com. In my case, it truly is. MyFavoriteOliveOil.com. MyFavoriteOliveOil.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're going to take a fascinating journey to visit with a survivor of stage 4 cancer. He's James Templeton. He's written a book entitled, I Used to Have Cancer, How I Found My Own Way Back to Health. James also, coincidentally, is the life partner of someone who's familiar to many of our Intelligent Medicine listeners because we interview her quite frequently here on Intelligent Medicine. She's one of our go-to experts on diet and detoxification. It's world-famous Anne Louise Gittleman. So, James, that's quite a distinction. You are the partner of Anne Louise Gittleman. I guess you in your own right, of course, are the author of this great book. So tell us a little bit about your journey and how it came about that you were diagnosed with a life-threatening cancer and then ultimately beat it.
Well, it's nice being with you, Dr. Ron, and it was quite a shock to me because back over 30 years ago, I was living in Texas, and I'm a fifth-generation Texan, and I was living, you know, a great life. I thought I had everything going for me, and I had a wife, a beautiful wife. I had a young daughter that wasn't even 2 years old yet, and I had several very successful businesses that I had built up, you know, from scratch, and everything was just going great. I guess you could say I had life by the tail. I even lived on a small farm, you know, and I had a few cattle, and I had a lot of nice, you know, things going on, I guess you could say, you know. And I was even in great, tremendous physical fitness shape. Mm-hmm. I was one of these runners, like you see, running all over the place. You know, I was the guy that you'd drive down the road, and here I am running. So I was this guy that thought he was doing the right thing. I worked out in the gym several days a week. And I was doing all this because my father and my grandfather both died at a very young age of heart disease. My father at 46 and my grandfather at 36. And I never really knew my grandfather, but we had this heart disease thing going on in the family. And my mother, she died before I was even 2 years old. So I had a lot of death in my family. Even I had a brother that died at the age of 8. So I had, you know, this death thing going on and the heart disease thing going on. And I just thought if I didn't do something, I was going to be the next one. And so when I started to think about this, I read a book, and it was by a guy by the name of Jim Fix.
Yeah.
And you probably remember him.
Yeah, Jim we remember the Jim Fix era, you know, the guy who basically single-handedly launched the running revolution.
Yes, he did. And I read his book, and he had the same thing, and I think his father died at the age of maybe 35 or something like that. And so Jim got into running, and he thought that he could just about eat anything he wanted as long as he ran and exercised and was in this tremendous health. And he just thought that that was going to be the ticket to everything. So I thought, well, if it works for Jim, it'll work for me, and I'll just do everything he's doing. So,
but you were running away from heart disease, but yes. The irony of life is that sometimes the very things that we anticipate, it turns out that life hits us upside the head with a 2x4.
Yes, it does. So I just thought that, you know, if I didn't do something, I was going to be next. So I got into this running thing, And I was feeling great. I noticed, though, one thing. I was a little tireder, and I felt this, feeling. Every time I'd run, I'd feel like, I'm really tired all the time, but I'll just push harder.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed I was coming down with a lot of colds and flus.
Oh, is this you were in your 30s at the time? You were in your 30s?
Yes, I was. Mm-hmm. I was in my early 30s. I was just feeling this, and I thought, well, I guess it's when you get to be 30, you don't feel as well.
Yeah.
So I didn't feel as well, but I was in good physical fitness shape. I guess it sounds weird, but I was really, out there, just 60 miles a week, putting it in, putting the time in. And so anyway, I decided that I would do what Jim did. So one day I went to the office, I grabbed the morning newspaper, I sat down, and I looked at the headlines, and it says, "Running guru Jim Fix dies of heart attack while jogging."
Wow.
And I remember that, and it just threw me almost, out of my chair.
So much for your sense of invulnerability, right? Because you thought,
yes.
As long as I keep doing this, emulating the lifestyle of this perfect physical specimen, I'll be fine.
That's right. And I thought that, that if Jim, had died of a heart attack, then, man, I better start refiguring everything I'm doing. Maybe I need to do something else. And it was a big shock to me. And I decided, though, I would go and get a real thorough checkup. And I was going to get one of these cardio stress tests, these cardiac stress tests that they did back then. And it would see exactly, by doing that, let me see exactly how good a shape I was really in. So I scheduled one of these with a internal medicine doctor there in town. I was living in a small town, and there was a guy there that did this kind of thing. And I went in there, and he says, well, he says, James, he says, you're in tremendous health here. He said, I've done a very thorough examination. He says, you are tremendous shape. He says, you broke the record in my office on the treadmill test. He said, no one's ever done this well. He said, you are doing something right. Whatever you're doing, just keep doing it. And so I like that. I like the sound of that. And he says, you're going to live a long time in this kind of shape. I wouldn't worry about the heart disease. So I felt really good on the way out of the office. He says, in fact, there's the only thing I could find wrong with you. He says, there's a mole on your back. And he says, that mole on your back looks a little different than the other moles. He said, it's probably nothing. But he said, I would go and get it checked out.
Mm-hmm.
When you get a chance, just go down to the dermatologist. There's one down the hall here in this building. And he says, he'll know exactly if it's anything to be concerned about. But I don't think it is.
Yep, I know the drill, because so often, I do that with patients. And I try to reassure them, but, I have my concerns, and I want to be thorough. And I, just in case, just make sure, maybe get a biopsy, that kind of thing.
Yeah, so I didn't think much about it, and a few weeks later, I decided to go get it checked out. So I go into the dermatologist's office, and I'm sitting there and waiting on him to come in. And he says, why don't you remove your shirt and let me see what you got? And he looked at that mole, and instantly, he just started to really talk loud. He says, oh, my gosh. He says, I think you have melanoma, just like that. I mean, he didn't know for sure. But he thought it was melanoma. I guess he had seen it before. But he got very excited, and he started to go on about how we might have to remove a large portion of the tissue in my back. He says, I think this, is for sure melanoma. He says, this is something very serious here to be concerned with.
And you're saying to yourself, wait a minute, slow down here. Right?
Yeah.
Because it's almost like he took a delight in being so clinically perfect, and yet the way he transmitted the message to you kind of freaked you out.
It did freak me out. He had this excitement in his voice, like he had won the lottery or something.
Okay.
You made his day,
because, he got tired of just seeing people with ordinary sunspots, and, that was kind of like a case of the month for him.
It was. I got to thinking, I guess he gets excited because he saw something, you know, that, like you say, he hadn't seen in a while. And anyway, he got all excited, and I didn't like his bedside manner, and I just remember saying, look, you know, I'm going to think about this. I'll get back to you. And I went home and barely could make it home. I was just in shock and very upset.
Because what's interesting, excuse me, what's interesting about this is, you know, people who get diagnosed with cancer, the diagnosis often happens later in life. You know, that 75, they get told that they have, you know, lung cancer, pancreatic cancer. Yeah, that's curtailing their longevity. But there are very few cancers that are as deadly and can strike so early as melanoma, right? There's something about melanoma that's a particularly dread disease because it can hit, you know, a 20-year-old or a 35-year-old, and it can literally be your death knell.
Yes. Yeah, and I went home, and my wife says, look, let's get a second opinion. You know, let's don't just take his word for it. Let's get a second opinion. So I went in to see another dermatologist down in Houston, a guy that I'd seen before. And when I got to see him, he says, well, it looks kind of suspicious to me also. He says, you know, there's only one way we're going to know. He says, you know, you need to have someone take this out. And he says, I've got a friend that is a world-renowned oncologist. And he says, I think you should go see him, and he'll know for sure if it needs to be taken out. And he says, if you have to go to anybody, this will be the guy to go to. So I did. I went, you know, right over there in a day or two, right to see this guy. And I went in, and he says, well, it looks suspicious to me also. He says, but let's just take it out here in the office. Let's see exactly what it is. I'll send it to the lab. And so he went on, and he removed it, and he removed a big, large plug out of my back. It was probably a 2-inch square plug. And he says, you know, I'll send it into the lab. I'll get back to you in a few days. Don't worry. Go home. There's nothing you can do. And of course, that's all I did was worry because mm-hmm. the anticipation yep. of not knowing. Mm-hmm. And I was walking around on pins and needles and didn't sleep very well, just probably most people that are going through this kind of thing. So anyway, he calls me up. It's about, you know, almost 2 weeks later. I didn't know why it was taking so long, but he calls me up and he tells me on the phone, he says, James, he says, I've got some good news and I got some bad news.
Hmm.
And he says,
I hate when people say that because it's usually, it's usually 95% bad.
I didn't know what he was going to say first, you know, and he says, well, the good news, he says, is that it's melanoma.
That's the good news?
And I'm like, melanoma's good news like that? And he goes, well, wait a minute before you, you know, draw anything to a conclusion on this. He says, listen, he says, we think we got it all around that perimeter area of that incision. He says, there's no signs of any of the cancer around the edges. So mm-hmm. we think that there's a good chance we got it all.
Okay.
He says, the bad news, though, he says, it's very deep. And he says, when it's mm-hmm. deep, like this, he says, we're going to have to call it a stage 4.
Right.
So, and he says, this is a measurement that they measure, you know, on a Clark scale measurement right. on a melanoma.
Yeah, so let me just explain briefly to our listeners, is when you get a biopsy for melanoma, it's a really tricky thing because if the melanoma is below a certain level in your skin, even if it doesn't appear to have spread, it's very likely to be picked up by the lymphatic system and carried to your lymph nodes. This statistically, and it's a difference of just a mere millimeters. And if you look at, you know, you hold your finger and your thumb together and you hold them very close together, that's a millimeter. So a couple of millimeters makes a big difference in terms of, it's fine, we took it out, live, you know, you'll have a great life, it's gone, versus you're at risk for metastatic melanoma, which is, okay, it doesn't get any worse than stage 4. There's 1, 2, 3, and 4. And stage 4, you were already stage 4, not by virtue of the fact that it had spread to your brain or to your liver, but just because it was a couple of millimeters below the surface of your skin.
Yeah. And he went on to say that, you know, we're going to have to really keep a close eye on this because this is more likely to spread than not. And he says, you know, we got to have you come in every 3 months and we'll check you out. We'll feel under your arms and, you know, when you're growing, we'll check the lymph nodes out because that's usually where it goes. And he says, you know, we'll just see how you're doing. There's nothing else you can do. Try not to worry. Live your normal life. There's nothing you can do at this point.
No lifestyle suggestions, nothing, you know, diet, supplements, immunotherapy, nothing along those lines.
No, nothing like that. So here I am. I mean, I become very, very upset, of course. Now I have stage 4 cancer. Now I have to worry, and I just didn't want to do anything after that. I was a very ambitious young man, and I loved to, work and go to the office and be creative and all that. And I just got to where I didn't want to do anything. I didn't want to get out of bed in the morning. Mm. All I wanted to do was feel sorry for myself. Yeah. So, you know, this went on and on and on, and I wasn't the same guy that my wife had married, and I just wasn't fun to be around. And I had started to read a little bit about the melanoma. There wasn't the internet back then, so we didn't have something we could look up in 5 minutes' time. So I started to ask around, and there was a doctor friend of ours that said, he says, I hate to tell you, but people with stage 4 melanoma usually don't live over 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, when he said that, I felt like, well, you know.
Yep, the statistics are pretty abysmal, yeah.
I might as well start planning the end of my life. And, you know, I just, and I think I had this thing that everybody in town probably thought I was, you know, dying. And you know, they didn't necessarily, but I just started to think like that. And I just wasn't a happy camper. And I went in two different times to get checked out. Everything seemed to be good. So I got to thinking, well, maybe we'll never see this thing again. And, so the longer it goes on, you know, not finding anything, the more you start to feel a little bit better. But before I knew it, I just, you know, my wife, I guess, couldn't deal with it, and she wasn't happy with me any longer, and maybe it brought some other issues up, and she decided to move into town and take my little girl. And after that, I just kind of lost my interest in living. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't even care if I was going to be around anymore for a while. And I just started to, feel really sorry for myself and feel like my life was totally over, and started going out with some of my old buddies and drinking again and trying to get it off my mind. And, you know, I'd go out and drink. You felt pretty good. The next day you got the same problem. So,
right. James, so we know that there, from what you were doing at the time, from the standpoint of something called psychoneuroimmunology, was exactly the wrong recipe for cancer, which is something that I think you subsequently learned in your career with dealing with this, right?
Yes, I did. And, before I knew it, long story short, I was taking a shower, and I found a lump in my groin, and it started to get bigger, and I felt it. And I went in to see the doctor. The doctor says, well, it's probably okay. You might have bumped into something. I don't think we're going to worry right now. Just come back in 3 months. Well, I didn't know what to do other than do what he said, but it just started getting bigger and bigger. And I went back to him a few weeks later, and I said, this thing is really getting bigger. And he looked at it, and he says, you know, I think you're right. We need to go in and, remove it and see exactly what it is. Hopefully it'll just be something small, a little small incision. So he checked me in the hospital. He said, let's go in the morning, the first thing, and let's see what it is. And he did. He went in and did the surgery. And when I woke up from that surgery, I knew I was in trouble because I had this huge, huge bandage on my groin. And I knew that that wasn't good. And before I knew it, the doctor comes in to the recovery room and he says, well, I'm sorry to tell you, he says, but the cancer has spread. It's in your lymphatic system. It's down in your lymph nodes. And we removed all your lymph nodes in that area down in that right side of your groin, the whole area. He said, so we're going to have to really get aggressive now. Because, you've got, it's already metastasized. And he says to me, he says, I want you to do 80 chemotherapy treatments.
Hmm.
And he says, we're going to do experimental chemotherapy. He said most chemotherapy doesn't respond
right.
very well to melanoma.
Just a footnote, James, is that back then, you know, I guess this is about 25 or 30 years ago, there was no established protocol for melanoma. Everything was experimental. And chemo was kind of a dismal failure in terms of treating it. Now they have immunotherapies. They can be somewhat successful, but they have devastating side effects, the current immunotherapies for melanoma that target melanoma. But then that didn't exist. So the therapies that you were offered were kind of on a wing and a prayer, right? You know, very experimental, very iffy, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It was just because he says, you know, this is all we know to do, and we're going to do something called hypothermia. And he says, we'll elevate your temperature. And they do that nowadays. I see that now that they're doing that for, mm-hmm. I don't know about melanoma. But he says, we'll elevate your temperature, and we're going to get it up as high as we can, you know, without, you know, basically killing you, I guess. Get it up as high as they can. And, you know, I'm sure it was over 105 or so. But
is this an MD Anderson? Is this an established cancer center? Or was this?
It was down in a hospital in Houston, and it wasn't MD Anderson, but it was a hospital that the doctor originally came from MD Anderson. He had his own clinic.
Because it sounds innovative. I mean, it sounds innovative. I mean, they just didn't know what to do then, so they said, okay, let's try this out.
Yeah. So they started to, you know, that's what they would do. They would do that. He says, you're also going to have a lymph drainage pump because we removed all those lymph nodes. You're going to have a lot of swelling in your leg, and you're going to have to use this several hours a day. So that's going to be something you have to do. If you don't, you could lose your leg.
Mm.
So I didn't want that to happen. So I had to do that. So he also went on to tell me right then, he says, well, he didn't want to tell me, but I got it out of him. He says to me, he says, I think you have a 20% chance of surviving 3 to 5 years if you can get through these chemotherapy treatments. He says, if you don't do the chemotherapy, I don't know what else to do. It's probably not a good chance. You probably won't be around that much longer.
Mm-hmm.
And he says to me, he says, that's just from his experience, and that's all he could tell me. And he just didn't sound good to me, and I was very, very upset. And I knew there had to be something else I could do. I knew that, you know, I just had to think about and find some other way. And I was there, and after a few days in the hospital recovering from this surgery, which was pretty painful, that the recovery, you know, anytime you get a 10-inch incision in your groin area and, you know, and all this fluid drainage and everything, but I knew that I needed to find something, and I needed to really find something quick. And I got a phone call, and this phone call was from a minister of mine at a church that I went to time to time. And he calls me up, and he says to me, he says, James, he says, I heard you were in here. He says, I've been praying for you, and a lot of people in town have been praying for you. And he says, I just want you to know you're not alone. And he says, if anybody can beat this cancer, you can. He says, you're a tough guy. I know you know how to push yourself. I know you know how to not quit. He says, so I know you can do this. And he went on, he was giving me a pep talk, kind of like I was in the locker room at halftime or something in a championship football game or something. And this guy was an ex-baseball player, so he knew how to kind of motivate. And he was a nice guy, and he was a runner also. He was older than me, but I respected him, you know, a lot. And he went on to tell me, he says, listen, he says, I want to tell you one thing. He says, you don't give in to this. And he says, you beat this SOB in cancer. That's exactly what he said. He used the other term. But he said that, and I was shocked because, you know, I never heard the guy talk like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it got my attention, and it made me start to think. And I said, you know, I am going to have to fight this. I can't give in to this because I was just laying around depressed, feeling sorry for myself.
Mm-hmm.
And when he said that, you know, I just knew that there had to be a better way, and I was going to find it. come hell or high water, I guess you could say. So I started to pray. I started to pray like I'd never prayed in my life, like 100 times harder than I'd ever prayed for anything. And I wasn't a religious guy that prayed every day and all that, but I'm telling you, I was desperate, and I needed to get an answer, and I needed to pray. And I prayed, and I felt like every cell in my body was praying. And I was laying in that hospital bed, and when I got through praying, I bet it wasn't but maybe 20 minutes later, I got a knock on the hospital door, and it was from a friend of mine. He comes through the door, a friend of mine I hadn't seen in seven and a half years or so, from college. He comes in the door, he had these papers in his hand, and he comes in, and he says, well, I was driving around the area, and he said, I heard about you in here from one of our old friends, and I feel so bad about it, and I knew that, you were here, and yesterday, a friend of mine at the office and me were talking, and he said, I read an article about a guy that cured himself of cancer using a diet and lifestyle. And he said, I asked him to get that article and bring it to me, and I'd bring it to you. And the guy did. So that's what I have in my hand here. I have an article. And it's a book review about a guy that wrote a book about his healing story. And the guy's name was Dirk Benedict. And Dirk Benedict was a guy that was on TV. He was on a TV show called The A-Team back in the 80s.
And Dirk was one of the early proponents of macrobiotics. I remember from the beginnings of, you know, when I was practicing in the 1980s, he was a figure on the macrobiotic scene. James, can I ask this? At this is a good point at which to pause, because we divide our podcast into two parts, and I want to hear more about your journey. But it sounds like your pastor put some fight back into you, and then through the power of prayer, a potential solution was delivered to your doorstep. So let's hear in part two how that played out. James Templeton's book, I Used to Have Cancer, How I Found My Own Way Back to Health. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.